You're listening to Chickens Can't See Cubes, the podcast all about absolutely 100% true facts that are not made up. I'm your host, Piper Dawes, and with me as always is Christopher Parr, director of the Munchausen Institute for Totally Real Research. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Chris has gathered his favourite facts from the Institute's... Whoa, I've just read the wrong bit. I knew I'd fucking do that as well. Right. Just delete the other bit. Fucking hell. This is, unfortunately, the last episode of the podcast. And for the final show, we're going to fire a whole ton of facts at you, lightning round style. Chris has gathered his favourite final facts from the Institute's continuing activity, and he's going to share them with us today. Chris, why are we going?
Well, Piper, I'm dying.
What, really?
To tell you about the great opportunity I've been given.
I hate you. What's your great opportunity, Chris?
I've been asked to join the first manned mission to Mars as head researcher.
Well, I didn't know they were sending a manned mission to Mars. What are you researching then?
Well, funnily enough, Piper, it's Mars.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well...
What do you think could be researching the fucking textile industry in the 19th century?
Right, well, that's very exciting, Chris.
Yeah, we're not leaving until next year, but training is starting next week. So, unfortunately, I won't be able to do the podcast anymore. I'm hoping I can get into some sort of Planet of the Apes scenario and return to Earth after the inevitable ape uprising. Although there are some chimps on the mission, which does suggest that it might be more of a 2001 Planet of the Apes scenario than a 1968 Planet of the Apes scenario, which is unfortunate.
Well, okay then. Should we do the last podcast, Chris, and hope for the best?
Yes, in the words of Inspector Dirty Harry Callahan, if you were an academic and not either a condemnation or condonement of fascist policing, depending on your perspective... I know what you're thinking. Did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I kind of lost track myself. But being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you? Fact.
It's time for the first fact of the show. Over to you, Chris.
Donald Trump tried to remake Die Hard.
Donald Trump, friend of the podcast, an avid triker, has cameoed in many movies and even starred in his own TV show. But this could be one step too far for me, Chris. Remaking the world's greatest Christmas movie? What is this hellish nightmare?
So this was a screenplay that Trump commissioned back in 2020. During the Antifa protests in the middle of the year. And the finished film was planned to be part of his campaign for re-election in November of that year.
Oh, okay, okay. What would it actually involve?
Well, the plot was basically the same as the film Die Hard, with a few key differences. It would have been set in Trump Tower in New York rather than the Nagasaki Tower in Los Angeles. And the tower would have been invaded by Antifa, while Donald Trump opposed them.
Who would have actually played Hans Gruber?
Well, it would have been Hans Gruber, because Hans Gruber wasn't a member of Antifa. It would have been an original character, most likely a heavy-handed swipe at the terrorist organisation Trump tried to portray Antifa as.
Right, yes, yeah, yeah, okay. The character Trump... Would that have been played by Trump as well?
Well, no, because it's an action-heavy film and Donald Trump is an old, old man. So the plan was to have a young hench actor and use digital effects to put Trump's head onto that hench actor's body.
That's beautiful.
No.
No, it's not.
One more thing before we move on, Piper.
Okay.
The working title of the film, we don't know if this would have been the title had the film been made, but the working title was Trump Hard.
Fucking hell. Yep, good, fine. Okay, well, shall we move on to fact number 2, Chris?
Go on then.
Well, you go on then.
All right, yes. An assassin used 1,500-year-old ink to fool the authorities.
So long-time listeners of the show will know that in order for a fact to make it onto an episode, it at least has to be interesting. It's not enough for it to merely be a fact. So I'm guessing this assassin that wrote in 1500-year-old ink isn't also 1500 years old. Otherwise, it's sort of just a historical thing that happened.
What?
You said that an assassin used 1500-year-old ink to fool authorities.
Yeah.
This didn't happen 1500 years old, presumably.
If this happened 1,500 years ago, the ink would have been new. It wouldn't have been 1,500 years old. Because that's how fucking time works, Piper.
I was just like, well, that doesn't sound very interesting at all. But actually, yeah, fair enough. Good point. Right, so he's not trying to fool current authorities, is he? That'd be weird.
No, he is trying to fool current authorities. And were you thinking somebody murders somebody in the past, which is his present, using new ink, which would be old to us, thinking to himself, ha ha ha, this will really fool people 1500 years from now?
Well, I didn't think it was going to be anything to do with us now. I thought you meant that it was, you were just telling me about a thing that happened 1500 years ago. So,
but the ink would have been new.
Yes, that is true. Okay, so tell us about this fact, Chris.
So forensic scientists can analyse ink used in various crimes to identify the perpetrators of those crimes. And this assassin killed a foreign ambassador in the US and taunted authorities with a note, which when analysed turned out to have been written with ink that at this point in time, Piper, was 1,500 years old and was the kind of ink used by medieval monks to copy out the Bible when they did Bible copying.
Right. Okay. It's technically a simple concept, but not the one I was thinking of.
It's not technically a simple concept. It is a simple concept.
Yes, just one that I wasn't getting. So normal everyday assassin now uses 1,500-year-old ink to mess with the people who are trying to catch him.
Yeah, so based on the analysis of the ink, the FBI began searching for a medieval monk, thinking that a medieval monk had done the assassinating before they eventually came to their senses and realised that that doesn't make any sense. And it's a good thing you're not in the FBI, Piper, otherwise you would still be searching for this medieval monk, wouldn't you?
So, I'm assuming that the assassin did it to throw them off.
Yes.
What sort of FBI did he think that did this assassin think that they were dealing with here? Did they think that they were just a band of pipers trying to find someone? Because presumably they expected it to throw them off entirely and actually, you know, lose the scent and, you know, keep looking after some 1,500-year-old monk. Like, what did they expect to happen? Did they think that they were going to just keep the FBI confused indefinitely?
Well, not indefinitely, but I guess if you're an assassin on the lam, then any amount of time the authorities spend dicking about is good for you.
I guess, yeah, if I was an assassin and I was like, right, I'm going to write this note to... wait, hang on, I can't write it with a normal pen. What have I got to hand? Hang on, how did he get a hold of 1,500-year-old ink?
I mean, presumably they didn't have it to hand. They would have planned this in advance.
Yes. I mean, this is quite a big upscale thing, like, to get a hold of, like...
Upscale? It's not an Asda assassination, it's a Marks and Spencer assassination.
Yeah, I mean, that is quite a lot of work to go into what is probably only going to throw them off for maybe at max a day or so. He must have had it to hand. That's a proper, like, just a punt. Just like, oh, I'll just throw this in the mix just to see what happens, see if it'll throw them off.
Well, no, you're wrong there, Piper, because the assassin turned out to have been a fan of rival podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, who had heard about ink forensics from that podcast and decided to use it in their assassinatings.
How did they catch them in the end then?
By looking for people who had recently acquired 1,500-year-old ink.
So you're telling me, Chris, that this weird thing that they did to just throw them off for a couple of days was the thing that incriminated them in the end?
Yes. Crime never pays.
Well, do you want to do a third fact, Chris?
Yes. It used to be fashionable to get surgery.
Fashions and trends change constantly, and changes can be attributed to all sorts of things. The mood of a nation, technology, weather, economics, pandemics. So what made this trend trendy, Chris?
So advances in medicine in the 19th century especially those surrounding disinfectant and anaesthesia, meant that surgery was a more viable approach to illness and so became more popular.
Right.
And because it was a new thing, it became fashionable to have surgery.
Yeah, because you could actually do it without it being necessarily as life-threatening as it was. People were like, I want everyone to know that I've got surgery. What? Okay, fine.
Yeah, so the most common thing to get were simpler procedures like tonsillectomies or appendectomies.
That surprises me that... Hang on, what's an appendectomy? Oh, appendix. Yeah, okay. That's a... Stop it. No, but that surprises me though, because those two things, they're not immediately obvious what you've got, are they? I would have thought that they'd gone for something where it's like, I don't know, like you had an eye removed or something, and someone would go, oh, why do you have that? Be like, because I can afford surgery, or because I'm one of those cool people who get surgery now. I'm a surgery person. It's a conversation starter. You can't have a conversation starter with an appendectomy, can you?
Well, you can, because you can go, I got an appendectomy, and then show everyone your appendectomy score, therefore starting a conversation. Or I got a tonsillectomy, look. Ah.
Yeah, I guess it, even if this was popular to do, the sort of people who'd go on about it aren't the sort of people who are popular at parties, are they?
Well, it was mostly rich people who tend to be popular at parties because they're the ones who have the parties.
True. Okay, fair enough.
But within the European aristocracy, surgery kind of became a shorthand for social status. So if you were the kind of person who had got a tonsillectomy or an appendectomy, then you were kind of at the bottom of the aristocracy. You were a minor noble. But the more powerful would have fingers, toes, or even entire limbs surgically removed to show how wealthy and powerful they were.
Wow. Okay.
Hello?
Hi.
Are you rushing off to get surgery yourself now?
I'm...
To the surgery boutique.
What would I get lopped off, Chris? What should...
I mean, they say your head, but that might cause like more problems than it would solve.
I don't know. There was that chicken that managed to survive without head.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's the fourth and by no means final fact of the show. Over to you, Chris.
There was a cult based around slinkies.
Arguably one of the greatest things to come out of the 90s, aside from Pogs, Tazos and Emma Bunton, slinkies were the crowning achievement of any self-respecting staircase in the 90s.
Yeah, I need to stop you there, Pi, because a slinky wasn't invented in the 1950s.
What?
Yeah, if you'd done any research whatsoever.
Mate, I didn't think I needed to.
Well, that's your fucking problem, isn't it? Why, Piper? I know everything, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Wow, okay. Well, they were very popular in the 90s.
Yes, and the preceding four fucking decades.
Okay, fine. So they've been around a while. Why was there a cult based around slinkies, Chris?
Well, the cult basically would set a slinky walking down a set of stairs and make predictions based on which step it would stop on.
Oh, so this was just an exercise in randomness and prediction?
Yeah, so each step would have a decision to be made, or the slinky could make statements by stopping on steps with letters or numbers on them, thereby spelling out a sentence.
Oh, so sort of like a slinky-based Ouija board?
Kind of, yeah.
So when you say that that each step had like a decision to be made... So you mean that the slinky could either stop on it or keep moving? Not that there was like a question on each step or anything?
Well, no, if there was a decision to be made, there was like various choices or whatever, then they would put those choices on different steps and make the decision based on what step the slinky stopped on.
What sort of magnitude of cult are we talking here, Chris? Was this a big national thing? Were they making decisions based on, you know, important decisions based on the slinky?
They weren't deciding the fate of the world or anything.
But what sort of things were they deciding with the slinky fate generator?
Just usual cult stuff, like should we wear brown robes or grey robes?
Okay, so they built a cult around the Slinky, and the Slinky's entire purpose was to decide how the cult should aesthetically be.
Well, it's not the entire purpose. It was an example, Piper.
Okay, right. Just cult stuff then, like, you know, yeah, okay. Well, should we meet on a Wednesday or a Thursday?
Yeah.
Okay.
And over time, the cult imbued different individual Slinkies with different properties. So there was a Slinky that was better at predicting the future. There was a Slinky that was very pessimistic. There was a Slinky that was considered quite playful. Oh. And they built special staircases for the Slinkies. So there was one staircase that just had letters and numbers down it, and another one which they could put different decisions onto.
Is this in the UK, or is this like...
This was in America.
I shouldn't be surprised by that. So somewhere in America, there's what, like a warehouse full of staircases that go nowhere with random numbers and shit on them. Imagine just turning up, like coming across that and trying to work out what it was. That's really weird. So the predictions that they made, were there any things that they actually tried to predict that were actually sort of useful outside the cult? Like they were trying to predict when it was going to rain, or like when it, you know, whether there was going to be another pandemic or anything like that?
No, it was just the usual nonsense from this kind of thing. The world will end in 2019. Sylvester Stallone will cure cancer. There was some confusion over that as to whether it meant that Sylvester Stallone will invent a cure for cancer, or if Sylvester Stallone is himself the cure for cancer. And perhaps most preposterously of all, that Greg will succeed Logan as CEO of Waystar Royco in the HBO original series Succession.
Good. Right, I'm gonna go out on a limb, set Chris, and say we should move on to another fact. Fuck me, it's a fifth fact.
Horses were rebranded in their fight against cars.
Right, just like putting to one side the wording of that and the imagery I've got right now about horses and cars fighting each other. Lots of things have had a rebrand over time. Everyone's mum's favourite internet search engine, Yahoo, used to be called Jerry and David's Guide to the World Wide Web. The World Wrestling Foundation had the biggest fight of their career and lost to the Worldwide Fund for Nature. And of course, American airline company Oceanic rebranded as EasyJet in the early 2000s. So what did they name horses, Chris?
You forgot asbestos.
Fucking hell, how could I forget asbestos?
Asbestos is asbestos, Piper.
The thing is, if you want to rebrand, you want to sort of completely change everything. I guess it's my point. Like, what was the rebrand for horses then?
So back in the early 20th century, cars quickly overtook horses as the most popular form of personal transportation, which did not please the kind of people who make money from horses, like horse breeders and horse traders, etc. So they tried various tactics to either besmirch cars or make horses look more appealing than cars.
Like what?
They emphasised the companionship offered by horses, which you can't get from a car.
I mean, some people do try.
Yes, but David Cronenberg's Crash aside. They try to emphasise the fact that horses can go off-road while cars need a road.
That's true, generally, unless you've got a special car, yeah.
Yeah, but those special cars didn't exist back then.
Right, yes, okay. But yeah, so you said that they changed the look of horses as well.
I did not say that.
I thought you did.
Oh, was it when I said make horses look more appealing?
Yes, that's the one.
I just meant like see more appealing, appear more appealing. Not like physically look more appealing. Just like if you're looking for transportation, then horses would look more appealing than a car. That's all I meant.
Right, I see. Okay.
But in retaliation for this kind of thing, car manufacturers branded horses as bad for the environment because of the poo that they leave everywhere.
That's a clever rebuttal, to be honest.
Yeah, but also ironic given the effect the combustion engine has had on the environment.
Do you think they knew that it was ironic, the car companies at the time? Do you think they were like...
Not back then, no. History has proven it ironic.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay, it's only hilarious given what we know.
Well, hilarious isn't quite the word I'd use. Existentially terrifying, perhaps.
So just checking and covering all bases, Chris, was there any physical rebranding?
No, there wasn't. I don't know what you would do for that.
I've got some ideas.
Have you? Okay, go on then.
Well, first of all, you could call them something more fun than horses.
Like what?
Well, I mean, if your main competitor is the car, then you could just call them mega cars or czars or something. Like something that makes it sound literally better than a car.
Yeah, I mean, mega car would suggest that it's a car, but better than the normal car. But horses aren't cars at all, are they? And czar would just make people think they're buying a Russian ruler.
Fair enough. All right. Well, keep the name then, but at least do something with the horse to make it a little bit more exotic. Go faster, Stripe, would be fun.
Like a zebra.
Would you like to do another fact?
Yes. British police are concerned about the rise in backstreet endoscopies.
Here in the UK, we have free healthcare for all, endoscopies included. So why are people shunning the NHS in favour of back alley tube shovers, Chris?
Well, as the past almost 2 years has proven, Piper, many people mistrust mainstream medicine because they're stupid. And so a lot of these people seek invasive medical advice from less than legal sources.
Okay, and that includes getting a tube shoved into you in a back alley.
Well, not necessarily in a back alley. Back alley was just a figure of speech. So a lot of alternative medical practitioners have been caught stealing endoscopes from actual hospitals and GP practices to use in their own unproven practices.
Right, so if there's some Reiki professional that's fallen on hard times, they might just nick an endoscope and say, well, you know, I can also put a tube in you. And what happens then? What happens after that? Does that help with the alternative medicine?
Well, I guess they just make up some bullshit. Ooh, I've seen your chakras. It's not looking good from the inside.
Yeah, your outer chakras, I can already see. I can already do that for free, but your inner ones, that'll cost.
More concerning are the homemade endoscopes that some practitioners are making, usually from things like the little spy cameras you can get and a bit of hose pipe. There's also the scam endoscopies, where a quack will just jam like a phone charger up your bum and then tell you you've got rectal cancer and it'll cost £10,000 to fly Sylvester Stallone in to cure it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if it's up your bum, it doesn't matter what goes up there. They could just literally just...
I mean, it does matter what goes up there, Piper. Piper Dawes Medical Clinic. It doesn't matter what goes up there.
And on the seventh fact, Chris facted again, or something. Here is said fact.
The Victorians were concerned about counterfeit toilet paper.
I don't know much about Victorian England, but I know that it was rife with crime. Seriously, anywhere in the country you were never more than 10 feet from crime. So it's surprising they were that bothered about fake TP. What's up with that, Chris?
So back when it was first invented in the Victorian times, toilet paper was seen as a luxury. And so each sheet was watermarked to prove its provenance, to prove that it was a genuine piece of proper posh person's toilet paper.
Watermarked as in that, like on photos?
Yeah, or like on banknotes and stuff. But this didn't stop poor people from wanting to use this newfangled way of cleaning your bottom after doing a poo. But because they couldn't afford the toilet paper, a black market for counterfeit toilet paper emerged in Victorian England.
So there was somewhere you could go and get toilet paper that still worked as toilet paper. Let me just confirm that. It still did the job.
Oh, yes, you could still wipe your bum with it. It was still paper you could wipe your bum with, yeah. But it wasn't officially sanctioned watermarked toilet paper.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with toilet paper that we just take for granted. So it did the bare minimum, but it was just like, so where could you go to get these fake bit rolls of toilet paper then?
Well, there'd be dodgy people selling it on the street, or there might be a shop that was masquerading as, you know, a bookshop or something, but actually they sold fake toilet paper.
Okay, so if you were one of those people that are like, I really want to have toilet paper and not have to wipe my bum with my hands anymore, they went into a shop and just went, have you got any of the good stuff?
he could go in and say, have you got any shitty books?
Ooh.
And they'd be like, yes, we do have some less well-regarded books in stock. Step into the back room and I'll show you our stock of shitty books.
I mean, an entire room devoted to toilet paper is wonderfully overkill. But I suppose if it was such an expensive luxury item back then, it was, you know, probably worth doing.
Well, perhaps not worth it because the fake bog roll was made of cheaper materials than the real stuff. And it often had things like wooden splinters or grit in it.
Of all the things I want in my toilet paper, grit is probably not on that high on the list. So,
to be honest, Piper, it's not on my list at all. I don't know why it's on yours. It's at some point where you're like, well, I can't have any of these things, so I guess I'll have to have grit in my toilet paper.
This sounds quite a reasonably scaled operation. Like, how did the Victorian police go about catching the counterfeiters?
Well, this was very, very short-lived. Because people eventually realised that toilet paper was the way to go for everyone and not just the rich people. So there was an effort to catch them, but it was very quickly curtailed because toilet paper became widespread.
Right, yeah, okay. So they didn't really need to in the end, it all just sort of fell apart.
Yeah.
Much like the cheap toilet paper. Would you like to do fact number 8, Chris?
Yes, I would. Michael Jackson had a monkey autograph sweatshop.
Right, so I'm guessing this isn't a side hustle where the King of Pop got famous monkeys to sign their own autographs for their fans en masse.
No, I mean, how many famous monkeys do you know, Piper?
Not many. There's the spider monkey in Friends. There's the monkey in the PG Tips adverts.
Well, he's not a monkey, he's a knitted toy.
Yeah, the newer ones it is, but then the older ones where they actually got...
They were chimpanzees aren't monkeys, Piper. You should know this. This is why you're going to be first against the wall in the inevitable ape uprising.
Do tell us about this fact, Chris.
Yeah, so Michael Jackson received constant requests for autographs through the post. And to deal with this, he trained 20 monkeys to write out his signature constantly so that he could then send them to the people who wanted his autograph.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, it makes sense in a weird sort of Michael Jackson kind of way that, like, you know, he hasn't got the time to do it, so he gets someone to do it for him. But why monkeys, Chris?
Well, you didn't need to pay them actual money. You just paid them in fruit. And they would get paid less fruit for bad signatures.
Wait, did so he got... He got 20 monkeys to sign his signature as many times as they could and, you know, get it as close to accurate as possible. But, like, is this... I'm guessing this isn't freely available knowledge that this happened. Otherwise, they wouldn't be considered authentic, would they?
Well, this came to light after his death. But now that he is dead, it is now impossible to verify what autographs out there are authentic and which ones were written by monkeys.
Right, of course. So does that mean, this is what I was going to ask actually, does that mean then that all of Michael Jackson's signatures are worthless, or that they just decided we can't work out which ones are going to be monkey ones and which ones are actually Michael Jackson's ones, so let's just keep them all as face value, you know, like they're all worth what Michael Jackson's autograph would be.
Yeah, the second one.
Oh, so the stupid scheme paid off even after death.
Yes, it paid off in life because usually a botched signature would be just outright rejected and a waste of time. But sometimes they would accidentally resemble another celebrity's autograph. And so these would then be sold fraudulently as that celebrity's autograph. And so made Jackson a bit more money.
So that's the side hustle right there. Okay, cool.
And this whole thing came to light after his death when Michael Jackson's estate was caught attempting to sell what they were claiming was Adolf Hitler's signature, which had been written out erroneously by a monkey.
Were they thinking of Hitler at the time by accident? They'd just come up with the wrong thing?
Why would a monkey be thinking of Hitler, Piper?
I don't know. It's your fact, Chris.
Does it mean I control the brains of monkeys?
No, but imagine if you did.
If I did, none of them would be thinking of Hitler.
Well, that's good. That was a test, Chris, and you passed. any more on that?
No.
Fact number nine.
The longest race in the world is still going on.
Right, if I'm late for work, I can just about manage a brisk jog to the end of my street before I feel like my lungs have collapsed. So I can't fathom any real running distances. What is this longest race in the world, Chris?
So this was a race between a bunch of rich people back in the 1930s to see which of the rich people could circumnavigate the globe the fastest, using any means at their disposal.
Right, I don't know why I assumed it was a running race. Cool, okay.
By the end of the race, which initially took just under a year, all competitors had accused all the others of cheating. So they carried on circumnavigating the globe to see if they could decide a winner the second time round. And this has now been going on since the 1930s, with the original competitors, their children, and now even some of their grandchildren constantly going around the world over and over again until one of them wins. But they probably won't because they're just going to accuse each other of cheating again.
But, I mean, we've got the technology to see where a lot of cheating is happening. But I guess if you're circumnavigating the entire world, you're probably not going to be able to pay attention to every little thing everyone's doing. So if anyone's accused of cheating by other members, you've got to take that seriously and just carry on racing. Oh God, this could literally go on forever. Technically though, Chris, if their children and their grandchildren are competing in their place now, this is technically a relay race. At what point do they pass the baton on to the next generation? Is it when they drop dead? Are they running alongside, their children running alongside, waiting for them to die? And then they're like, cool, right, I'll carry on for you. Let's go. We'll do the funeral later.
No, it's more a case of when a competitor is no longer able to physically carry on, they can nominate a next of kin to carry on in their place.
Okay, that sounds much more sensible.
And running the race is in fact necessary for a lot of these people in order to get their inheritance from their parents or grandparents. It's stipulated in their wills.
So there's quite a lot riding on this perpetual race.
Well, I'm increasingly less riding on it as the cost of constantly circumnavigating the globe eats into the estates of these people. Many a Tuscan villa has been sold to fund this. The entire economy of Tuscany has been ruined by this race.
We've hit the 10th fact of the episode.
It's a new record.
It is a new record. I mean, it's been a new record 6 times so far in this episode. And it's still to play for. It's probably going to happen again, Chris.
During the 1998 World Cup, the English football squad were advised to eat nothing but frogs' legs and snails.
Who advised the players to do this, Chris? Was it another weird superstition, like not washing your underwear before a match or kissing the ball before a free kick?
No. So the 1998 World Cup was held in France. And upon their departure from England, the English football squad was issued a booklet on how to behave in France during the tournament, as well as key French phrases to get them through the several weeks they would spend in France. Phrases like, do you do chips and where's the pub? The booklet had advice on the kind of food available. The booklet was meant to advise players to at least try frog's legs and escargot, as edible snails are known over there, to be polite. But a misprint in the booklet meant that it actually told the players to only eat frog's legs and escargot. And many people think that this misunderstanding is why England lost their penalty shootout against Argentina in the round of 16.
I mean, did it appear to be anything other than just them not being very good in the game?
I don't know what you're asking, Piper. I mean, but what else could it have been other than either not being good or only eating frog's legs and snails?
There could have been some evidence that it might not have been their lack of talent. They could have been like, right, well, it was a penalty shootout. And as you can see, I can't kick the ball through this huge pile of sick that has mounted up through all.
This was all televised and nobody was recorded vomiting on the ball. So I think the idea was that it affected their competence at the game rather than, you know, producing such a prodigious amount of vomit that they were unable to play the game.
Right, yeah, okay. So in the match, they're just like, well, do you know what? I feel I don't feel like I can competently play football right now. Why is that, do you think? Well, maybe it's what we ate. No, it can't be that. The French wouldn't give us a... Maybe they did it on purpose, Chris. Maybe it is a conspiracy. Sorry, I'm having thoughts thick and fast right now.
Well, one thought is thick and fast for you, Piper.
Well, no, I had one and then another one overtook quickly.
Two thoughts? Wow. Are you okay, Pub? You just sit down.
I'm sitting down, but it's not enough.
This was a typo in a booklet printed by the English team. So it wasn't the French.
Oh, right. Okay.
So unfortunately, okay, your barrage of thoughts is not relevant here.
Okay. Anything else before we move on?
No.
It's time for another fact. I hope you're strapped into your fact seat because it's about to get facty.
During World War One, the Germans weaponized poo.
Yeah, this is just continuing a proud warmongering tradition of behaving like a toddler, I think, Chris, isn't it?
I suppose. So, on the Western Front in World War One, are largely comprised of trenches, the Germans attempted to demoralise British forces by catapulting feces over no man's land into the British trenches.
So this wasn't like a poo gun, which was obviously my next thought. When you say catapulting, is this in a sort of, like, did they use like a medieval catapult? Like the...
No, they didn't acquire some medieval trebuchets. They constructed kind of ad hoc catapults from what you might find in the German trench and used those to fire their poo over no man's land into the British trenches.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, a good set of elastic-waisted underpants would probably do the job, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
And it has the added benefit of possibly already containing the ammunition.
But they would also occasionally have planes fly over the British trenches and drop payloads of poo onto the British.
Wait, hang on. I watched a documentary about the trenches and they talked about these people who used to run up and down the trenches looking for grenades and chucking them back. Did they have someone to do that with poo then?
No, because poo does not explode. So there's no point throwing it back out.
Well, it's not so much a, you know, a safety thing. I assumed, you know, well, we've got some extra horrible things now. We can use that to our advantage. It's like a positive thing.
Oh, you mean gathering up the poo the Germans have just thrown at you and firing it back at them?
Yeah, I mean, what's more insulting? I can't actually think of anything. That's probably the most insulting thing to happen to you. Have your own shit thrown at you.
The British didn't do that, perhaps out of politeness. But many British soldiers did die of dysentery due to the exposure to fecal matter.
Right, so as weapons go, pretty effective then.
Yes, although it was something of a Pyrrhic victory for the Germans, as the German forces did suffer under the diet necessary to produce the prodigious amount of poo.
The thing is, Chris, I mean, if you're gonna have a trench war, if you're gonna go as far as to actually fire stuff from the planes overhead, you're already playing dirty, really, aren't you? So you might as well just drop a fuck ton of water on them and just drown them in the trenches. It's easier than getting a load of people to take a load of all bran before the trench digging and get them to just shit in a massive vat and then fire that at them. Like, I feel like they're overthinking it.
I don't think there was a massive vat. I think perhaps that's your own thought there.
It is my own thought, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of them.
Well, two.
Well, yes, yeah.
it was more a case of each soldier was responsible for their own ammunition, as it were.
It's like being responsible for your own gun. I suppose it's like the same sort of thing.
Yeah, you're responsible for your own gun and your own bun.
Oh. right, well, let's do another fact then.
Beefeaters cheat by using mannequins.
All right, for those that don't know, the yeoman warders, or beefeaters, as they're colloquially... Oh, fucking hell. I knew I'd get that word wrong. It's hard to say.
Colloquially.
Goddamn. for those that don't know, the yeoman warders, or beefeaters, as they're colloquially... Oh, my... Is there another word I can use? For those that don't know, the yeoman warders, or beefeaters, as they're also known, due to their love of gastropubs and flavoured gin, are the guards at the Tower of London. What do you mean they're using mannequins, Chris?
Yeah, so the yeoman guard, as you say, they're the ones with the furry hats who have to stand perfectly still. So they have developed various methods to deal with the tedium and physical strain of standing perfectly still for ages. And one of these is surreptitiously replacing themselves with a mannequin dressed in the uniform of a beefeater, so they can pop off for a cheeky smoke or whatever you might want to do before the end of their tour of duty, as it's known.
This is the thing, Chris. Some of these, for people who haven't visited London, some of these beefeaters, some of these guards, they're obviously like, you know, guarding something away from the general public. But then some of them are really close up to you. Some of them are just kind of displays, essentially, for people. These must be pretty good mannequins to fool people.
Well, the only thing that's visible is the face of the mannequin, because the rest is wearing the uniform.
Yeah, true, actually, yeah. So they just need to get the face right, don't they?
Yeah, they can, you know, put some makeup on it to make it look a bit more human-like, I guess.
Yeah, you just bang that in there. Hang on, how do you do the transition, though?
Oh, well, that's the tricky part. Because as you say, some of these people are, like, right out in front on the street where tourists are passing. So kind of like the human waxworks we discussed in the previous episode, they've got to kind of wait for their moment to strike, as it were.
Right, yeah. So when everyone's sort of got a bit bored of staring at them and trying to make them laugh and just wandered off onto the next London thing and there's a bit of a lull, they can just, I don't know, dig their mannequin out of the back of their phone box that they stand in and get naked and put presumably the mannequin would have clothes of their own.
Yes, that would be the easiest way to do it, Piper, for the mannequin to already be clothed. It's not some weird Superman scenario.
No. So is that how it worked then? Or are there any other ways they could manage to sort of get away from the crowds for a bit and have a break?
Another method they use just to like have a little kind of like you scratch of their nose or whatever is they might have an accomplice standing nearby who will point and shout, "What in the world could that be?" So everybody looks over there, they can, you know, shift about a bit or whatever.
Oh, great. So yeah, literally someone who's in it just to create a distraction. I could do that. That'd be my job. I could literally do that. I could befriend a beefeater.
But how would you know you're befriending a beefeater and not a mannequin?
Well, I'd ask them a question only a beefeater would know the answer to.
Because they can't talk to you, can they?
Oh, yeah, because they're a mannequin, yeah.
No, because beefeaters, when they're on their tour of duty, they can't respond. They have just to stand there and not say anything.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, then I'd know they're a beefeater. No, because the mannequin can't. This is impossible, Chris. For the 13th time this episode, let's have another fact from the Institute.
The Incas once worshipped clothes.
I mean, I enjoy a good shopping trip to the Arndale Centre, Chris, but I can't imagine actually worshipping an item of clothing. Why were they worshipping clothes?
So, at one point in their history, the Incas believed that one of their gods had manifested in a particular robe.
Well, sorry, a god had manifested in a robe?
Yeah, like the god was the robe. Or so they believed.
Was there anything special about the robe? Or was it just a robe?
Yeah, it was just a robe. The specialness came from what they all believed about the robe. The high priest would wear the robe, and whatever they said or did was thought to be on behalf of the god who was the robe.
Okay, so yeah, so if you wear the robe, then you become like a conduit.
Yeah.
So I know there's nothing special about the robe, and I know there's not really a god, obviously. So what made them think that this random robe, out of all the other things in a wardrobe, was god?
We don't know.
All right. So we don't know at all. I mean, I imagine it's probably something like, we've got management coming down in the morning, and I've got nothing to show them god-wise.
Sorry, what management? What, are they a fucking insurance company?
Well, it sounds like a rush job is what I'm saying. They've got to have some reason to have another god. Well, they've probably gone, listen, the leader of the Inca tribe or whatever has just gone like, listen, tomorrow I'll show you, man. Like, we've got another god coming down and it's absolutely brilliant. And then they've forgotten about it and got pissed on whatever Incas drink. And then they've gone, shit, I've got nothing. And they've looked at their... their clothes and just gone, this will do.
Well, while we don't know what actually happened, I think I can say with certainty that what you just said wasn't it.
Any more on these Incas?
So this practice of believing this robe was a god came to an end when a priest wearing the god robe went on a killing spree throughout the Incan capital and said it was the god. And they all decided, well, probably not. So it's probably not the god anymore.
I think the Incan religious people seem to have a much better grasp on reality than religions these days. Maybe the Incans got it right, Chris. Maybe it was a god. No, that's silly. I'm happy to move on if you are.
Yeah, probably should, before you have any more thoughts.
Wow, will they ever stop delivering facts? Yes, but not yet. Here's fact 14.
More and more people are relying on emotional support rocks.
Rocks?
Yeah, like stone.
What is this, Chris? Why? Why is this happening?
So emotional support animals have become more popular in recent years due to a greater cultural acceptance of mental health issues. However, they are still controversial due to the difficulty in caring for any kind of animal and in the waste they will produce wherever you might take that animal. So some landlords, establishments and various airlines, etc. have banned at least some species of emotional support animal over the years. And this has led many people to adopt the clean and easy to look after emotional support rock.
So what you're saying here, Chris, or, you know, what is happening, is that because it's hard to look after living things, they're getting their emotional support from rocks.
Yes.
And how does that work?
The owner of the rock will imbue it with a personality from their own brain and then derive emotional support from that.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, because that is essentially like the very act of saying this is a pet rock rather than one of those normal rocks you can get for free in your back garden. That changes your perception of it. Okay, cool, fine. So these emotional support rocks, are they allowed on planes?
They are allowed on planes because they don't shit anywhere.
That's true. I mean, people shit and they're allowed on planes, but I suppose they're potty trained.
Yeah, people can get up and go shit in the toilets.
Yes, and though a rock can't do that, it doesn't need to.
Yes, that is correct. In a way, it's better than an emotional support animal because the personality and emotional support of the rock comes from the actual person, which means it's one step closer to them being able to emotionally support themselves. However, some people have ignored that aspect of it, and instead of getting emotional support rocks, they have gone with something with a bit more outside personality. There are those who have emotional support boglins.
All good things must come to an end, even with 100% true fact-based podcasts. Here is the 15th and final fact of the episode, and indeed the podcast as a whole. I can only assume we're going out with a bang. What is it, Chris?
Boris Johnson had a sex advisor.
Yeah, I think it was Russell Brand who once said it's important to end on a sexy note. Go on then, what do you mean a sex advisor?
So this was a person who, during Johnson's time as Mayor of London, Foreign Secretary and actual Prime Minister, advised Boris Johnson on how his sex life affected his professional life. So was he having enough sex with enough people to be able to do the job of Mayor of London, Foreign Secretary, Prime Minister?
Oh, okay, so not like you know, when his sex life permeates his professional life and how to handle that.
He's never been bothered about that.
No. So what sort of things did he help him with specifically then?
Well, that's about it, to be honest. It was just a guy who Johnson had who would say, oh, you've not done that well this week. You're a bit stressed out. Maybe have a bit more sex.
Okay, so he looks at his metrics. He looks at his, you know, abilities in work and, you know, sort of looks at his mannerisms and stuff in a sort of holistic worker sort of way and then goes, have a shag. Or don't, you know.
The sex advisor never advised Johnson to have less sex. I mean, this is the person who has an infinite number of children. Less sex has never been an option. So Boris Johnson no longer has a sex advisor, meaning that this was his ex-sex advisor.
Right.
The input on that is the aesthetic pleasure of the phrase ex-sex advisor. Had this sex advisor been a Tyrannosaurus Rex, it would have been Johnson's ex-sex Rex. Had that Tyrannosaurus Rex been Mexican, it would have been Johnson's ex-sex Mex Rex. If David Beckham had had a sex advisor who was a Mexican Tyrannosaurus Rex, the newspaper headline revealing this would be Beck's ex-sex Mex Rex.
That is it. That's the end of the final episode of Chickens Can't See Cubes with me, Piper Dawes. I can be found on Twitter at Piper Talks and Christopher Parr from the Munchausen Institute.
I could be found on Twitter at Trilby Norton, and the Institute will continue to be found at MuinFotoRere, MuinFotoRere.
Thank you to all of you who've listened to this weekly foray into factum that is Chickens Can't See Cubes over the last 82 episodes.
And remember, live free or Trump hard.
And we'll catch you once again when you listen to previous episodes or something. Goodbye.
Bye forever. Am I of a confession to make, Piper? It was all made up.
What do you mean it was all made up?
I made up all the facts. The Munchausen Institute for Totally Real Research doesn't even exist. I'm only joking. It was a simple lampoon on my part.
Fucking hell.
And shambling, because I've not said that yet.